The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
In 3, 2, 1. Welcome back, everybody, to an exciting episode of Arthropod, your entomology-themed podcast. I'm one of your hosts today, Michael Scavarla from Penn State University.
I'm one of your other hosts for the day, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
And today I'm your last host. I'm Jody Green from the University of Nebraska, Lincoln.
I'm going to leave that pause in there. What they couldn't see is John and Jody were looking at each other, each pointing back at the other one.
We each wanted the opportunity to be the last one to introduce ourselves this time, because usually that's you. But this time that door was open for us.
Well, there you go. How's it feel to be the last podcaster?
I loved it. I will treasure it always.
It is the highest honor our nation can give.
That's certainly something. So John usually introduces the podcast and leads us off. So the listeners will probably notice that I'm doing it today. And the reason I'm doing it today is we've teased for a while now that I'm interested in Napoleon and how insect vector diseases have changed the course of history and especially wrecked his armies in very specific ways. And guess what? Today, if you have been waiting, is the day. It's the first episode in what will probably be a four-part series.
That's just been unveiled to us.
I didn't tell John and Jody up front. Turns out, I started writing and just could not stop. I don't have the second through fourth episodes written yet, but episode one is ready, and that's what we're going to be talking about today.
Very exciting.
I think so.
That is. And you know who's going to be really excited? My brother-in-law, Matthew. He is going to be so excited to know that there's four parts to this.
I hope that you two enjoy this as much as I do, because if you don't, I feel like I'm going to be dragging you through it with me. I think it's really exciting, and I think the way I've got it planned out is going to work and be interesting.
You know who else is probably excited? The nation of France. I mean, I'm sure that they're really excited that their history will be highlighted in our little podcast. One, and two, I have absolutely no doubt that you will pronounce everything that is French in this story with an immaculate accent.
In the script that I'm looking at right here, this is gonna follow very similar to what John did with DDT, where it's kind of a Behind the Bastards type podcast style, where I've got a script where I'm gonna read through the script and then John and Jody can react to it in various ways, because they don't have any idea about this topic whatsoever. So I'm curious to get their reactions to things as we get to them. But I actually, in the script, have a caveat that we'll get to. My apologies to the French people. So with that, let's jump into it. This miniseries is, like we talked about, going to focus on the impact of insects, specifically insect vector diseases, on Napoleon's campaigns from the late 1700s through the early 1800s. Many listeners are likely unfamiliar with the time period, so this first episode is going to be a little bit different from other arthropod episodes, because it's going to be really history heavy. We're actually not going to get to most of the arthropod stuff today. So listeners, if you don't care about history, if you just aren't interested, you could maybe skip this episode, but I'd like to make a pitch that you should listen to it anyhow. We'll get to the bugs and how they affected Napoleon's armies, how those impacts changed history, and how those changes will still affect current geopolitical environments in subsequent episodes. But today I'd like to spend some time to put all of that into context, because context is really important. Otherwise, the stories and statistics just don't carry the weight that they should. I can tell you that yellow fever ravaged the troops that Napoleon sent to Saint-Domingue, and that only 3,000 of the 40,000 troops that he sent made it back to France alive. But that's not really that interesting if we don't know why he sent them and how that defeat changed the course of history in the Americas.
Context matters. It always matters.
It does.
It's an important piece of any discussion. If you lack context, how are you going to really understand the ultimate point of it, right?
Right. And with this specifically, Napoleon's rise to power and why he did what he did is just intimately tied with the French Revolution, which, especially as an American that learned nothing about it. I don't know, Jody, in Canada, did you learn anything about?
No. And even though I've known that we were going to do something like this for years, I have not, like, why isn't there like a, you know, one pager about Napoleon's whole entire life and everything else?
Because we're going to do an entire episode and it's still going to gloss over a lot. So yeah, this first episode is going to focus on why I think the Napoleonic era is the perfect time to examine the impact of arthropod vector diseases on the military. Napoleon's early life, how the state of France in the late 1700s led to the French Revolution, and then a quick overview of the revolution itself. And again, all of this to put into context Napoleon and what he did later, why he sent troops to where he did, and why these insect-vectored pathogens are so important in the course of world history. Napoleon's early career and decisions he made after becoming emperor were forged during and are direct results of the French Revolution, so it's integral to understand his motivations. The next three episodes then will each focus on a particular campaign where Napoleon's troops were wrecked by arthropod vector diseases. Now, specifically, we're going to look at Napoleon's invasion of Egypt and the Middle East, his attempt to suppress the Haitian Revolution, and his invasion of Russia. Those three episodes will all follow a similar arc where we'll talk about why Napoleon sent troops to those areas and summarize the campaigns, how disease affected his troops and led to their defeat. And we'll use that then as a springboard to talk about the pathogens and the arthropods that vector them. Because each in the three campaigns as well are three very different diseases vectored by three very different arthropods. Before we get too deep into this episode, I do want to lay out a couple caveats. First, much like Dan Carlin, if you've ever listened to Hardcore History, I'm a fan of history, but I am certainly not a historian. I am an entomologist, if even I can claim that title. I will try to be as accurate and factual as possible, but I'm mostly pulling from secondary sources and not primary sources. I like learning about all of these topics that we'll talk about today, but I'm not an expert and I don't claim to be. I'll include links to all of the resources that I'm using in the show notes. But up front, I do want to plug Mike Duncan's Revolutions podcast and Everett Rummage's Age of Napoleon podcast. Those were my gateways into this era and learning about it. And, you know, listeners, you're listening to a podcast now. Those are also podcasts, a similar medium. So that might be something that you're interested in checking out. Second is content warning. We're going to touch on a number of sensitive topics during this series, including slavery, racism, colonialism, war, death, and the description of diseases and disease symptoms. As a white cishet man, I'm going to try to cover these topics as respectfully and thoughtfully as I can, but I want to acknowledge up front that I'm coming from a place of privilege and will try my best not to slip up with it. Please know that no offense is intentional if I do mess up. And please let me know if you feel like I didn't handle any of those topics appropriately. I'm going to try my best. One post-recording warning. There are one or two instances of mild cursing due to some choice music drops that I've included. So if you are listening to this in the car with young children, please be advised. Finally, and here's the other caveat, I'm not fluent in French. So apologies to all the French people. You have a wonderful language. I'm inevitably going to butcher it.
It's okay. Jody knows French. She'll correct you.
Do you know French? Did you learn it as a Canadian?
I have a little bit of, French, Canadian French, French, Canadian
French.
Yeah. From when I was forced to take it, because that's what being bilingual is in Canada. Can I just go, oui, oui, ho, 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 ho.
We're off to a great start with the nation of France. Denmark loves us. France hates us. Totally going to cancel us.
Okay. So you guys ready to start this?
I am so excited. I really am. Like I have purposely avoided any Napoleonic content since I knew that you were writing these. Like I haven't listened. You told me about those other podcasts before and things like that. And you were saying, it sort of sounded like you were mining them for some information. I was like, I want to come in as clear as possible. I want you to just like wow and razzle dazzle me with your Napoleonic knowledge. And I'm super pumped about this. I've been waiting for this.
Good. I hope listeners that you are as excited as John. Jody, I hope to entice you as well.
I want to know all about it. And I have to tell you, you changed my life because I did watch Hamilton and I loved it.
And isn't it so good?
I listen to like the soundtrack all the time. It's in my head all the time. Love it.
So listeners, there's going to be some Hamilton drops when I edit this in post-recording. Just so you know, listen and be ready for some Hamilton because I'm going to tie it in. And I think it ties in really well to what we're talking about.
We've contacted Lin-Manuel Miranda through Twitter to see if he would be on those episodes, but I don't know if he's gotten back yet.
I haven't heard from him. So diseases, including insect vector diseases, have been an important X factor that can turn the tide of war since the dawn of organized militaries. One of the oldest examples we have is the Plague of Athens, which was documented by Thucydides in his account, History of the Peloponnesian War. In the 50 years prior to the Peloponnesian War, it saw the rise of Athens at the head of the Athenian Empire as the foremost power in Greece, much to the dismay of Sparta, which had previously claimed that role. Relations between the two powers slowly broke down, and in 431 BC, Sparta and her allies declared war on Athens and its allies. Sparta and allies, except for Corinth, were primarily land-based militaries. If you've ever seen the movie 300, yep.
I was wondering when it was going to come up.
Yeah. You're probably familiar with Sparta's near legendary forces. While Athens at the time was the foremost naval power in Greece, Sparta's strategy during the early stages of the war was to surround Athens and cut off them from land-based supplies. So in response, Athens pursued a policy of retreat to within the city walls and then relied on their naval supremacy to receive supplies from colonies and allies and just harass Spartan troop movements. This resulted in a mass migration of people from the countryside into an already highly populated Athens, which led to overpopulation and exacerbated poor hygiene and strained supplies. If you're familiar with disease dynamics, you can probably see where this is going. During the second year of the Peloponnesian War in 430 BC, an Athenian victory still seemed achievable. A plague swept through Athens. 75 to 100,000 people, about a quarter of the total population, were killed, including Pericles, the leading statesman of Athens at the time. The plague struck twice more in 429 BC and in the winter of 427 and 426. The war stretched for nearly 30 more years until 404 BC, but the much weakened Athens never really recovered to the point that an Athenian victory ever seemed possible after the plague came through. After the Peloponnesian War, Athens was reduced to a subjugated city instead of a leader of an empire. While we know many of the symptoms that plague caused, high fever, redness of the eyes, sore throat, and loss of voice, coughing and vomiting, extreme thirst and diarrhea, and ulcers across the body, we don't know what pathogen caused the plague. More than 30 different pathogens have been suggested, including typhus, bubonic plague, smallpox, measles, and even more exotic diseases such as Ebola and various hemorrhagic fevers. So we know that disease was an important factor that led to Athens' defeat, but we don't know what pathogen was responsible or where it came from. With that in mind, I find the Napoleonic era really interesting because of a number of factors and trends that coalesce for the first time. First, it's the first time in modern history that nations have large standing army, a nation at arms, as Lazare Carnot, the French Minister of War during the French Revolution, called it. During the French Revolution, the levée en masse, which was the first successful national conscription in modern history, resulted in 1.5 million Frenchmen being brought into the army. While the actual number of Frenchmen actively fighting in the army was likely closer to about 800,000, that absolutely dwarfed the 81,000-man Austrian and Prussian army, which was itself larger than any other army fielded in Europe since the fall of the Western Roman Empire 1,300 years prior. Even then, the Roman army peaked at around 300 to 500,000 soldiers in the late 2nd and early 3rd century, but those were spread across the entire empire and never engaged in a single conflict. So at this point that we're talking about, France has the biggest army that has ever been fielded, probably anywhere ever. Okay. Second, wars result in a movement of people across natural and national borders, which can bring disease to new areas via the army movements or expose the army to pathogens they're not accustomed to. The revolution in travel methods that preceded the Napoleonic campaigns including the ability to sail across oceans, meant that new areas and pathogens the French armies were exposed to were wildly different from what they were used to in France. During this series, we'll cover the campaigns that occurred in Egypt, Haiti, and Russia, all of which are as different from each other as they are from France. And the geographic breadth means that we can talk about three very different pathogens vectored by three very different insects, which I really like from a teaching perspective. This is kind of a way to get at things that are otherwise really unrelated.
It sounds like we're going for kind of a War of the Worlds principle almost, like these foreign invaders showing up. They don't have anything to protect them against the pathogens that are local, and it can take down even giant alien tripods or a million Frenchmen.
Yep.
Is what I'm saying.
Yes. And that's going to be especially important when we talk about the Haitian Revolution.
Okay.
Because if we think ahead to where that's at, Haiti's kind of tropical to subtropical, and it's got very different tropical diseases. Third, throughout much of history, we can only guess at the size of engaging armies. Like I mentioned just a moment ago, we can estimate the size of the Roman army in 200 AD to be 300 to 500,000 soldiers. But within that is a huge disparity between those two numbers. It's almost a twofold increase from the lowest to the highest. Part of that's because while a Roman legion was supposed to have 4,000 to 6,000 soldiers, the Romans were well known for having fielded legions at only 50 to 80% capacity. So while a battle might have five legions and 30,000 men on paper, the actual number might be closer to 15 to 20,000. Other reasons numbers reported by ancient authors might be suspect include changing the numbers of a combatants up or down for political purposes. Many histories were commissioned by emperors or those in charge is propaganda, so they're inherently biased. You can imagine that an ancient historian might add soldiers if an emperor wanted to project strength of the army or decrease the number of soldiers in the case of a defeat. We had fewer men than they did, and so that's why we lost, not we were evenly matched or even better matched than they were and still were defeated. And this is especially true when there's only one source of a battle and no corroborating sources. In contrast, we have many different records from the Napoleonic era, so we know that they're reasonably accurate. There might be some variation in numbers, but nothing like with ancient battles. It's the first time we have fairly accurate records about how soldiers died, so it could be more confident about how many soldiers died in battle versus how many died from disease and even what diseases killed them. It's the first time in history that we really have that kind of confidence. Fourthly, the Napoleonic era happened just before the advent of modern medicine. Louis Pasteur wouldn't begin his work until the 1850s, half a century after the events that we're going to discuss. So doctors in the time of the Napoleonic era were unaware of germ theory. They thought diseases were still caused by bad air or miasmas or bad weather. There were no antibiotics or modern medicines. And so pathogens were free to rip through armies unchecked, just as they had done during the Plague of Athens 2,200 years prior. Finally, it's hard to know how the world would be different if the Plague of Athens hadn't happened. Would Sparta have still defeated Athens? If Athens had prevailed, would it have mattered to us? Would world history have been radically different? Or would it have happened much like it did? Those events were so long ago that the impact of a different outcome is really just impossible to predict. But the Napoleonic era is close enough to our own time, only 300 years ago, that I feel like we can be reasonably reasonably predict the outcomes of certain battles or events had gone differently. And I feel pretty confident that our world today would be vastly different if it had. So when we come to those inflection points, I think it would be kind of fun to play with some historical what ifs. What if learning what we learn in this show, as I summarize it, like if Napoleon had won the Battle of Egypt or won the battles in Haiti and crushed the Haitian Revolution, how would history have turned out differently?
We'd probably be speaking French on this podcast, or we'd be better at it at least.
That is actually a fairly reasonable prediction, especially with regards to Haiti. So I'm excited for today and I'm excited for this whole podcast, but I think I am most excited to talk about the Haitian Revolution.
Okay.
So it's a couple episodes away, but I'm pretty stoked for that. So with that set up, let's talk about Napoleon and his personality and motivations that are the driving force behind the events that we're going to discuss. I'm sure both of you have probably heard of Napoleon. You've heard of him?
I've seen him in cartoons before.
Okay.
I think I know him pretty well.
So yeah, what are your impressions? When I say Napoleon, what like, what image comes to mind? What facts or ideas about him do you have?
I would say, unfortunately, the first thing that pops to my mind is, do you remember the cartoon Hysteria?
No.
It was like a history cartoon, and they would take historical figures and parody them and turn them into their own cartoon characters. Napoleon was in that. And of course, he is portrayed as sort of this very short man who's very angry all the time. It really leaned into all of the stereotypes, I think, that we've been taught about Napoleon. Jody, what do you think of when we talk about Napoleon?
Like the cartoon, was he on Looney Tunes ever?
Or Animaniacs. He's popped up in lots of places.
Yeah, well, it's weird. He's like a short guy with this hat and then tights.
Yeah.
Okay.
Perfect. And he's like yelling, but that was the cartoon. Like, he was just always yelling.
Oh, yeah. There's a Bugs Bunny short, Napoleon Bunny Part.
Yes.
By Fritz Freeling. That is a pretty classic one. I can't believe I forgot that.
Oh, we'll add some screen caps of that.
Yeah.
Maybe if Warner Brothers doesn't come after us to the show notes.
Bugs Bunny supports piracy. I mean,
sure.
That's a fact. Yes, but you just look at the images of him, and he is portrayed as shorter than Bugs Bunny, very angry, very snooty looking, I would say. Definitely not a very forgiving portrait of the man.
So would you be surprised if I told you that he actually wasn't short at all?
I wouldn't be, because I also have been on the internet and read like crack.com stuff. But I know that is something that blows a lot of people's mind. Like, we even have Napoleon complex that they talk about with people.
Yeah, when you're like shorter and have to prove yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it turns out Napoleon was, we don't know his exact height, but he was somewhere between 5'5 and 5'7. So he was as tall as I am. Not that most of you listeners have seen how tall I am, but I don't feel like I'm short.
Right.
He was actually about, or only maybe slightly shorter than the average male height of the day. This idea that he is short was popularized by James Guillory, who was a popular English satirist and the quote unquote father of the modern political cartoon. Mm-hmm. And that's how he depicted Napoleon in his prince, is this short, angry person. And Napoleon actually said of Guillory that he did more than all of the armies of Europe to bring me down. And you can see that, like, that's still, that image that Guillory painted of Napoleon is still what is like the popular conception of him. There's a couple other kind of, I don't know, historical inaccuracies that are popularly portrayed. Maybe some of the listeners have heard of these. It was said that Napoleon converted to Islam. I don't know if you've heard that.
No.
That was actually perpetuated by Napoleon himself in an effort to win over the Islamic population of Egypt during his campaign there. And we'll talk about that in the next episode a bit. But yeah, he went to Egypt and said, you know, I have great respect for Allah and Muhammad, his prophet, and really spun up like this idea that he was a friend of Islam and the Muslims.
Seems pretty savvy.
Yeah.
But he is Roman Catholic, right? That was the other thing I think I remember from being a kid.
Yes, he... Well, no.
Oh, okay. All right.
He actually didn't... Jody's showing us a picture of the Bugs Bunny short on her phone via Zoom. He is very short in those. Napoleon in France, after the French Revolution, kind of got rid of Roman Catholicism and became atheist, or at least deists. Napoleon himself didn't believe in any kind of superstitions, including most organized religions. He liked Muhammad because he was a powerful military leader and got people to do what he wanted, but you know, didn't have much respect or much use for superstition and religion.
Interesting.
Yeah. There's not a rumor, but it's often, I guess, said that Napoleon shot off the Sphinx's nose in Egypt while he was on campaign there. That's just entirely untrue. There are sketches made of the Sphinx from before the invasion that clearly show the nose missing. So his troops didn't desecrate the Sphinx. And it's also thought that Napoleon was poisoned. That's how he died when he was in exile. Those rumors actually started soon after he died and were revived in the 1960s. but a number of modern studies of his symptoms have concluded that none of them are actually associated with arsenic poisoning, which is the most common type of poisoning put forward. And all of them are associated with advanced stomach cancer. Yeah. So he almost certainly died of cancer and not poison, like has been suggested.
Neither of those sound like a fun way to go for a would-be world conqueror.
I mean, no. Stomach cancer sounds terrible.
Oh.
Napoleon was born in Corsica on the 15th of August, 1769. He's often described as Corsican or French, but actually said of himself, I am more Italian or Tuscan than a Corsican. So what's going on? Corsica is an island in the Mediterranean, if you're unfamiliar with it, and it was governed by the Republic of Genoa from 1284 through 755. So the culture and language of Corsica are heavily influenced by Genoa and other Italian city-states of the time. In fact, Corsican, the language, is part of the Italo-Dalmatian language family and is mutually intelligible with Italian. It's kind of like speaking Portuguese and Spanish. They're distinct languages, but you can still understand the person somewhat or even well.
Okay.
Napoleon himself descended from minor Tuscan and Genoese nobility on his father's and mother's sides, respectively. That being said, the families immigrated to Corsica in the 1500s, 200 years before Napoleon was even born, and had thoroughly intermarried with established Corsican nobility and had no connections beyond their ancestry to either city-state. So culturally, Napoleon may have felt this connection to those cities, but actually it was tenuous at best. I think of it like an Irish Chicago cop saying that they're 100% Irish, even though they've been here for five generations. You know, if that person went to Ireland, the person would look at them and say, no, mate, you're an American, to put it into kind of a modern context. Corsica declared independence from the Republic of Genoa in 1755, and Genoa tried and failed to stop them. Corsica remained an independent, self-declared republic until 1768, over 10 years. When Genoa ceded Corsica to France as part of a repayment for France's help in Corsica's attempt to suppress the Corsican revolt. So Genoa doesn't really have a claim to it except on paper and to say, here, France, Corsica's yours. Take it.
France, here's $50 then, I don't have.
Basically. Yeah. Yep. If you can go get it, you can have it. France then annexed Corsica in early 1769. And on the 9th of May, 1769, just 3 months before Napoleon was born, France won the Battle of Pont-Neuf and crushed Corsican resistance. So right before he was born, France kind of took Corsica into the fold of France. So Napoleon was all at the same time Tuscan, Corsican, and French. At the age of 9, Napoleon and his mother moved to mainland France, and he was awarded a scholarship to attend the military academy at Braine-l'Château. He didn't start to learn French until the age of 10. And while he eventually became fluent, he spoke with a heavy Corsican accent his entire life and was bullied for his slow fluency during his school years. While in school, he was also an outspoken Corsican nationalist. He wanted Corsica to become independent again, which combined with his quote unquote foreign nationality being from Corsica, even though it was part of France. That and his language skills with French didn't earn him any friends among his French classmates. So while Napoleon distinguished himself to his teachers for his grasp of mathematics, he really lacked any friends during this time and became really reserved and melancholy. He had a sad childhood. That doesn't excuse like what he does later, but you can kind of see like this sad, lonely boy getting bullied all the time, how that could evolve into somebody that has ambitions to rise above what life has dealt him.
Sure. It contextualizes a little bit the phenomenon that is Napoleon.
Yeah.
I mean, like you said, it's not an excuse, but it is sort of the origin story where either they're going to do what he did, or I guess there's also, to me, there's like this other path where he became a Corsican freedom fighter or something and like went home and tried to do that instead. But
that's, Let me get to that, because that is interesting that you bring that up. I kind of want to like go back in time and just give 9-year-old Napoleon a hug. Like,
I don't know if you
tell him
that
it'll
that.
Get better. Napoleon was admitted to the École Militaire, the military school, in 1784 as a teenager and trained to become a military officer. At this time, being in the military, being a military officer was a really good way for minor nobility to kind of rise up above what they otherwise might be able to.
But basically, huge mistake on their part. They never should have done that.
No, that was a huge mistake letting him in. But how could they know? When his father died and Napoleon's income was reduced while he was at school, he was actually forced to complete the last 2 years of his coursework in just 1 year, which is an impressive feat in and of itself. And he actually became the first Corsican to graduate from the school in 1785.
That's kind of awesome.
Yeah, like you got to get all this done. Like, buckle down and get it done.
Yeah.
Upon graduation, Napoleon was commissioned as a second lieutenant in an artillery regiment and then served in various posts for the next 4 years until the outbreak of the French Revolution in 1789. Despite the fact that even at that point, he was still a fervent and outspoken Corsican nationalist, Napoleon was transferred to Corsica, where he spent the first few years of the revolution fighting a three-way battle between the royalists, Republican revolutionaries, and Corsican nationalists. And during that time, Napoleon was influenced by the Jacobins and eventually became a Republican himself and kind of renounced his Corsican nationalism.
But that's kind of like a teeter-tot in history right there, right? Like, he could have gone a different way. We could have had a very different path.
Yeah, imagine if he would have stayed a Corsican nationalist and switched sides, and Corsica probably never would have become independent, but he also never would have risen through the ranks like he did to do what he did. Okay, for some context about what happens next, we're going to leave Napoleon here on the island of Corsica and rewind a bit to the start of the French Revolution. Napoleon was created and his actions directly informed by the revolution, but to understand that, I want to give a brief overview of the state of France at the end of the Ancien Régime. The Revolutions podcast that I mentioned up front has an entire season on the French Revolution that ran for 54 episodes, so I'm going to gloss over a lot. You could expand this into at least 54 podcast episodes. So we're going to condense that and hit the highlights. If you want to learn more, I really encourage you to go listen to that podcast. I thoroughly enjoyed it. When I say France, you might picture something like the unified nation states we have today. But at the end of the 1700s, it was anything but. In actuality, France was a patchwork of 39 provinces of wildly varying sizes that were acquired piecemeal through the years via marriage, inheritance, and conquest. Provinces often retained their own unique cultures, identities, and even languages, and brought with them their own sets of laws, privileges, responsibilities, and obligations when they were incorporated into the French kingdom. So depending on the province in question, there could be things that the king could or couldn't do, tribute he could or could not expect, rights and privileges he could or could not abuse. The semi-independent nature of the provinces also meant that different provinces had different internal tax structures and could and did enforce import and export tariffs when goods were shipped to and from neighboring provinces within the Kingdom of France. Then add to the mix the hundreds to thousands of towns and municipalities, each of which had their own lists of privileges and exemptions. And you can see that things get complicated within France fairly quickly. Prior to the French Revolution, there were some attempts at streamlining these internal operations by centralizing and strengthening the central government. For example, in the 1500s, various kings created generalités, which were more uniformly sized administrative tax districts whose borders often had little in common with the borders of the provinces. By the eve of the revolution, there were 36 generalités. Outside of the central government, the Catholic Church operated on its own completely different administrative map, which comprised of 136 dioceses organized into 28 archbishoprics, none of which aligned with the borders of the provinces or the generalities. And then on top of all of this, the legal system ran on its own maps, and the jurisdiction of each court might depend on geographic area, the manner of the complaint, the social status of the defendant, or the category of the property at stake. At the top of the legal system were 13 parlements, which acted like provincial appellate courts and legislative bodies. Much like the generalités, the parlements were originally created to increase the power of the centralized government. Because France didn't have a codified legal system at this time, the way England and the United States did, the parlements decided cases based on past precedent by wading through hundreds of years of legal documents. the lack of a legislative branch of government meant that this had the de facto effect of the Parlement acting like a legislature and passing laws based on the findings of their precedent. So while the Parlement were created to unify France and centralize the government, they ultimately became sources of disunity as they acquired their own sources of power and pushed back against the king.
This sounds incredibly confusing. Like, if I was just your average everyday Frenchman at this time, like, I wouldn't know which way was up. I would just farm and I would just say, this is my duck. Like, I would not mess with any of these politics.
Yeah. Here's the next paragraph. So this confusing patchwork of maps, administrative districts, and laws meant that there were innumerable internal barriers and power struggles within the kingdom, and it seemed like no two citizens of the king lived under exactly the same two sets of laws. And compare that to something like Britain, which had, they had a king, but they also had the Magna Carta and a parliament, or something even more revolutionary like the United States, which was coming about in this time where we have like three branches of government and a written constitution. Like, it just, this seems so anachronistic and so backwards. And even everybody in France recognized it at the time.
It seems vicious, honestly. Like, it seems like a mean way to try and rule over a group of people would be like, actually, there's like 12 different ways that we're doing this, and none of them agree on the other, on the way that we're doing it. None of our maps probably make any sense. Like, this just seems, it seems very pointy.
Yeah, it seems awful, and like, it needs fixed, right?
For sure. I would agree with that. I feel, is there still, would you say, we've been to France, you and I, we
traveled have been around to France
for a week and a half there. Obviously learned everything there was to know about the culture. No, I feel like there's still quite a bit of spirit of this. I would say, like, the parts of France that we visited were very disparate from one another, like in a way that even like comparing Pennsylvania to Kentucky to Nebraska, I feel like there's disparities there, but there was more there. Would you agree with that, Mike?
Yeah, we went to Paris and then south to Toulouse, and they felt very, very different.
Yeah.
Part of it is like urban versus rural, because Toulouse is a fairly rural area, if I remember correctly. But yeah, I agree. Like, it felt like it was different areas in a way that it doesn't feel like that when you travel through the United States. I wonder if part of that is because of their history versus our only a few hundred year history. Like,
yeah,
parts of the United States were settled by people from different areas of Europe, but ultimately we all kind of boil down together into America, even though it's a huge country.
It's true. And I mean, yeah, our states are different, but like, I guess in my memory, even Toulouse has this sort of orange hue to it, and Paris had this like blue hue to it. And I don't have that when I have memories of places in America. Like, everything has the same sort of color to it. But I feel like it was just very different worlds that they lived in there. It was a fascinating place for sure. I like Toulouse more. How about you?
Oh, I love Toulouse. I would live there if I could. I loved it. I would love to go back.
Jody, have you ever been to France?
I have not been to France.
You should go. It's gorgeous.
We could do Arthropod in France.
Ooh. Yeah, let's let COVID get fixed, and then we'll all go to France and do a live Arthropod show there.
Like 150th episode spectacular or something.
Ooh, okay. Let's do the life of Fabre.
What? Perfect. There from his go. House.
From there you go.
Clearly they would let us do that. Yeah, obviously. Clearly they would let our podcast equipment in there.
Do you want me to tell you how France was even more complicated?
Yes,
what we talked about.
You've definitely hooked me. Like, I can see where the pressure is building here. Like, if I was Napoleon at this time, I also would probably have ended up doing what he did, just because I couldn't handle the miasma of the government.
Oh, it gets worse. So within this legal and political mess, the 27 million subjects of the French monarchy were divided into the three estates, capital T, capital E, three estates, which was itself a holdover of the old medieval feudal system. The first estate included the clergy, the second estate included the nobles, and the third estate was everybody else. So the third estate, everybody else, that comprised 95% of the population of France, most of which were peasants. In the countryside, this included the landless peasants who eked out a living doing day labor and other jobs, peasants who owned or leased a plot to farm. Although it should be noted that the plots were often so small they could barely sustain a family, let alone turn a profit. And a small percentage of independent farmers who owned enough land to turn a profit and usually owned the equipment they could rent out to their poor neighbors. In the towns and cities, this peasant hierarchy was reflected in the unskilled day laborers, the skilled tradesmen who operated under a medieval guild system and often had years of unpaid apprenticeships before they could become established, and the bourgeoisie, who were the wealthy merchant class and middle class professionals who, as a class, had started to accumulate most of the wealth of the kingdom.
Hold on. Is this where the term fourth estate comes from? The fourth estate for the press?
Being the press? Oh.
I thought it was the fifth. Wasn't there a show called The Fifth Estate?
I don't know that one. I just know the fourth estate is journalism.
Well, I didn't know that.
I have no idea, but I wouldn't be surprised, maybe. Sidebar from post-editing. The Fourth Estate does indeed refer to the press. Thomas Carlyle, who wrote the first definitive history of the French Revolution in three volumes, attributes it to Edmund Burke, a member of the British House of Commons, and he has this quote. Burke said there were three estates in Parliament, but in the reporter's gallery yonder, there sat a fourth estate more important far than they all.
There was a show called The Fifth Estate. Oh, it was in Canada. That's why we don't know.
Well, we should all watch it watch every episode for the next episode. So one of the main goals of these wealthy bourgeoisie was to rise beyond the ranks of the third estate and into that of the second estate, the nobles. The best way to do this was to use their accumulated wealth to purchase land as well as government positions, which were called venal offices and were often inside the judiciary, inside those parlements, the various courts. The second estate were the nobles, which included somewhere around 120 to 400,000 people, so only 1 to 2% of the entire population of France. But they owned fully 1/4 to 1/3 of all the land in France and held feudal rights to much of the rest. Beyond the prestige, being a noble came with certain rights and privileges, including, in many cases, an outright exemption from taxes on land. This exemption from land taxes was, in fact, one of the most basic reasons someone in the bourgeoisie would try to buy their way into the second estate. The first estate, I'm not going to say much about, except to say that it broadly reflected the second and third estates. The bishops and other high-ranking officials were appointed by the king and were often second sons of nobles of the second estate, and had direct control of the land and tithes owned or given to the church. While the majority of parish priests, the common rank and file of the first estate, were drawn from the ranks of the third estate peasants and didn't have any say on where or how tithes they collected, which were supposed to be used for running the church, were spent. So while the confusing political subdivisions and administrative maps in the feudal estate system were obviously anachronistic and problematic at the time, what pushed France over the edge into revolution was the broken financial situation. See, unlike in Great Britain, where Parliament had controlled the revenue and spending, in France, the crown controlled spending but had no control over the revenue. Collecting taxes and revenue fell to the various parlements, and while the crown could propose new taxes, those taxes had to be registered by the parlement, which refused to do so as they feared any new taxes would cut into their own revenue.
Yeah, this sounds like a great system. Like, there's absolutely no way this could go wrong.
Since the Parlement refused to register new taxes, the only other option for creating new taxes and revenue was for the kings to call together the Estates General, which was kind of like a legislative body that was made up of elected representatives of the three estates that met at the discretion of the king. So there's really no standing legislative body in France. But if the king wants to call one of these to do new taxes, they can.
That almost sounds like a good idea.
Well, I love this because, yeah, well. However, because the Estates General could debate issues other than taxes, and those issues might not always be in the interest of the king, the body hadn't been called together since 1614, even though there had been financial incentives to do so for 100 years. So that almost 200 years this body had not been called.
Okay.
Yeah.
The king's not a fan is what you're saying.
Yeah. Because they might pass laws that he doesn't like, even though he needs to raise those taxes.
It seems like he could fix that, though. It seems like he could be like, you know what? Actually, all this thing does is the tax stuff. Like, you're the tax estate now.
Oh, wait. So these structural problems, combined with the fact that the monarchy was overspending for decades, culminated in a series of financial crises in the mid-1700s, including a partial default in 1770. France then helped finance the American colonies during the American War of Independence in the late 1770s, largely through borrowing, which exacerbated the financial issues when France had to pay back those loans with interest. So thank you, France, for helping us gain our independence. But
sorry about those loans.
Sorry about the loans.
They say the price of my war's not a price that they're willing to pay. Insane! You cheat with the French, now I'm fighting with France and with Spain.
So everything came to a head when the crown found itself completely broke, unable to secure capital via new loans because they had defaulted and had too many loans out already, unable to raise new taxes, and unable to pay off the interest of the loans it had taken out. So in 1789, King Louis XVI was forced to call the Estates General for the first and ultimately last time. Historically, the Estates General had given equal representation to the three estates and voted by order, so that each estate collectively got one vote. But because the Estates General had not been called in 175 years, the public was invited to weigh in on how it should look. There's your first problem. This is important because up to and until that point, passing new taxes, attempts at reform, and politics in general had been conducted exclusively by the crown and the nobility. The peasants and the bourgeoisie had no political voice or pull, and the opportunity to do so now invited a new awakening within the Third Estate. They looked around and, realizing that they made up the vast majority of the population, demanded more representation in the Estates General, including a doubling of the seats in the Third Estate to 575, compared to 303 for the First Estate and 291 to the Second Estate, and voting by head rather by order so that they would not continuously be outvoted 2-1 by the First and Second Estates. This political awakening was driven in part by pamphlets and petitions written and financed by the quote-unquote liberal nobles, a minority of members of the Second Estate that realized reform and equality had to happen and were willing to give up some of their own privileges in the process. One of the most famous quote-unquote liberal nobles, and we'll talk about in a bit, many people have probably heard of, is the Marquis de Lafayette.
Hey, oui, oui, mon ami. Je m'appelle Lafayette, the Lancelot of the revolutionary set. I came from afar just to say bonsoir to the king, cause it's toi who is the best, c'est moi.
So the matter
of one of the coolest guys ever.
Speaking of Mike Duncan, the guy that did the Revolutions podcast, he's writing his second book, which focuses entirely on Lafayette, and I am super pumped.
Yeah, I want to read that book. There should be a Lafayette movie. I don't know if there is one from France necessarily, but like that guy led an amazing life, very interesting life. And we've all lived in places that are named after him or currently still live in places named after him. Like he had a huge impact on this nation. And I feel like we don't talk about him enough.
I know. I have tried to incorporate as much Lafayette material into this as I can, even though he's like Napoleon adjacent. I would love to do an entire thing on Lafayette. He's so cool.
It's like a thing in my family to have an L middle initial with your L last name. And I tried to talk my wife into letting me use that. If we ever had a kid that was maybe a boy, I could use Lafayette for his middle name, but she didn't bite.
That is dope. And I wish I would have thought of that from my children. The matter of voting by head or order was not resolved by the time the Estates General first met in May of 1889. So the first order of business was to verify the credentials of the elected members. Officially, the Estates were supposed to meet individually to do this. However, the Third Estate insisted on meeting as a whole body to verify credentials and establish a precedent for voting by head, and refused to conduct any official business until that happened. So you can see, here's the first push of the Third Estate, the 95% of the peasants, to have a voice. The Second Estate balked at this with a vote of 186 to 46, which resulted in a deadlock that lasted for almost a month. The deadlock was only broken when a slow trickle of parish priests from the Second Estate, who identified more with the peasants of the Third Estate rather than the rich bishops of their own estate, started joining the members of the Third Estate. By June 19th, more than 100 priests had joined the meeting of the Third Estate, and they then declared themselves the National Assembly. While the newly formed National Assembly invited members of the First and Second Estates to join them, they made it clear that they would begin legislating with or without them.
Nice.
On the 20th of June, 1789, King Louis tried to disperse the National Assembly and lock them out of the building they had been meeting in. In response, they reassembled at a nearby tennis court and took the tennis court oath, wherein they vowed not to separate until France had a constitution.
And that's where we play Wimbledon now. Just kidding.
I don't know. I don't think so.
I was being facetious. Anyway, that's amazing. Like, clearly, yeah, I'll lock them out of the building and then this won't happen anymore. Like, that's the way to defeat a Congress, basically.
Yep. It's just amazing that they even did this. Like, they just got together and said, nope, we're doing this new thing. The oath drew heavily upon the United States Declaration of Independence. And within a week, the majority of the Second Estate and 47 nobles of the First Estate had joined the National Assembly. So at this point, like, parts of all of the estates are bought into this National Assembly thing.
This train is rolling.
Yep.
Democracy.
So the Estates General never even, like, they started meeting and never even got off the ground. They never even did, like, a roll call. Rumor swirled among the urban poor of Paris, who widely supported the National Assembly, that King Louis was going to bring in Swiss mercenaries to break up the body. So when the king dismissed his popular finance minister on the 11th of July, Parisians took this as a sign that conservative elements in the court were executing a coup with the goal of getting rid of the National Assembly. Demonstrations started the next day, which led to the seizure of 30,000 muskets by the crowd, but no powder or shot. Protests
still heavy. Still can hit somebody with it.
Still heavy and still can hit somebody. You just need that powder and shot to turn this into, like, a real deal. Protests and riots continued until July 14th, when a crowd gathered outside the Bastille, which was a medieval fortress in the middle of Paris that had been converted to a prison, although it only held 7 prisoners that day. While the Bastille was seen as a symbol of royal tyranny, the more immediate reason the crowd gathered was the 250 barrels of gunpowder that had been stored in the fortress for safekeeping. The crowd attempted to negotiate the surrender of the garrison, but were met with the barrel of a cannon. Around 1:30 p.m., the crowd broke into an undefended courtyard, at which point spontaneous gunfire erupted. We don't really know which side shot first, but it started.
Fighting. I have a pretty good feeling.
Since the peasants didn't actually have gunpowder?
Yeah, I just feel it in my heart a little bit.
Yeah.
The cop shot first.
Fighting continued until 3 p.m. when the mob was reinforced with 2 cannons. With little food, no water, and the threat of the cannons, the Marquis Delaunay, the commander of the Bastille, attempted to negotiate the safe surrender and passage of his men. The crowd rebuffed his offer, and he surrendered anyhow. Delaunay was badly beaten, and while the crowd debated what to do with him, he shouted, "Enough, let me die," and kicked a pastry cook in the groin. The crowd then stabbed him to death and set his head upon a pike. King Louis learned of the storming the next morning through the Duke of Rochefoucauld and asked, "Is it a revolt?" To which the Duke replied, "No, sire, it's not a revolt. It's a revolution."
Ooh.
There are some good quotes here.
That's in the trailer for sure of my movie that I'm making about this.
While the riots and the storming of the Bastille were happening, the cause of the new constitution was taken up by the National Assembly. The initial draft was written by 2 men in consultation with a third. The first author was the Abbé Sieyès, a clergyman who was pivotal in getting the Second Estate to join the Third Estate and form the National Assembly. The second author is someone you and many in the audience listening may have heard of. Can you take a guess at the Frenchman that Americans are going to know? Oh, we mentioned him already.
The Marquis de Lafayette.
Yeah. It's the hero of two worlds.
Everyone give it up for America's favorite fighting Frenchman.
I'm taking this horse by the reins, wicked red coat weathered with blood stains. And I'm never gonna stop until I make a drop of random up and scatter the remains down. Watch me engaging them, escaping them, and raging them out. I go to France for more fun. I come back with more guns and ships.
And just so I can put in another Hamilton drop, who do you think the Abbe and the Marquis de Lafayette consulted with while writing the document?
Would it be the first Secretary of State of the United States of America?
It would be.
The second Vice President and the third President?
It would be.
Thomas Jefferson?
You haven't met him yet, you haven't had the chance, because he's been kicking ass as the ambassador to France. But someone's got to keep the American promise. You simply must meet Thomas.
It was Thomas Jefferson, who was in France at the time as the ambassador.
He partied there for a little while.
He did, like 10 years.
Yeah. A man of many contrasts. A lot of podcast episodes could be done about Thomas Jefferson, too, I think.
The document that Sayers and Lafayette put before the National Assembly was the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen. It was actually one of the most consequential documents to be written in the course of human history. The Declaration contained 18 articles that spelled out the rights of all citizens, or the rights that all citizens should have under the law. And unlike the American Constitution and Bill of Rights, which enshrined a specific political system in specific laws, the Declaration of the Rights of Man was more aspirational. So it was a starting point from which to develop a constitution, but not the law itself. It's also directly referenced in Hamilton.
There is no more status quo, but the sun comes up and the world still spins. I helped Lafayette draft a declaration, then I said I gotta go.
While the declaration asserted a number of important principles, including popular sovereignty, unlike the divine right of kings that had dominated during the medieval era, and social equality among citizens, what we're most interested in for this series is Article 1, which I'll read in full. Men are born and remain free and equal in rights. Social distinctions can be founded only on the common good. Now, for context, slavery was basically at this point outlawed in mainland France for reasons we'll talk about when we get to the episode on the Haitian Revolution. But it was a driving economic force in the French Caribbean sugar colony of Saint-Domingue. At this time, enslaved people made up 90% of the population of Saint-Domingue, compared to 30 to 40% in the southern United States. We'll dive into the race dynamics of Saint-Domingue when we get to the Haitian Revolution, but suffice to say that when the enslaved people of Saint-Domingue learned that the National Assembly had declared that, quote unquote, all men are born and remain free and equal in rights, it was a big deal. And one of the major events that set off the Haitian Revolution, which ultimately will draw Napoleon's forces onto the island.
They were like, that sounds like a good idea. Let's do that here too.
Yep. And there were complications and they said, no, we're going to take it for ourselves. Napoleon, remember him? The focus of this episode?
Yeah, yeah.
Over the next year and a half, the National Assembly passed major reforms, such as abolishing feudalism and aristocratic titles, exerting state control over the Catholic Church, and extending the right to vote, although there were still major disagreements over which men should vote, and no one considered that women should vote. But it's still more equitable than it had been. They also debated what role the king should play, but for the most part, everybody thought they should stay a constitutional monarchy with King Louis playing some kind of role. And eventually they settled on him having a veto power over legislation. So the National Assembly will propose legislation and pass it, but King Louis could veto it if he wanted. While these debates happened, and this is taking in popular consciousness, at least to me, the storming of the Bastille and then the Reign of Terror during the French Revolution happened like bing, bang, boom. They're right after each other. The French Revolution takes 10 years. So this bit that we're talking about right here takes almost a year and a half. It's kind of a slow roll. So while these debates happened, King Louis was forced to swear allegiance to the new constitution. The general population held him in such high regard, especially after his apparent support of the revolutionary cause, but he was still held under virtual house arrest in Tuileries Palace in Paris. At the urging of his wife, Queen Marie Antoinette, somebody many people have probably heard of, and his brother, King Louis and his family fled Paris in June of 1791 in an attempt to link up with 10,000 loyal soldiers stationed at Montmédy in the French border. However, due to a series of delays, mainly due to the king's indecision, they were recognized en route and arrested at Varennes and Argonne, about 150 miles from Paris and only 30 miles from Montmédy. The flight to Varennes, as this episode is now known, soured popular opinion against King Louis, as it was clear that he then didn't support the revolution. While all this unfolded, the monarchies of Europe viewed the French Revolution as a direct threat to their own power. Who were these peasants that thought they were equal to the king? And what happens if those revolutionary ideas spread to their own countries? So in response to the revolution, Holy Roman Emperor Leopold II, who was the brother of Queen Antoinette, and King Frederick Willem II of Prussia issued a decree that was pretty vague, but said that severe consequences would happen if any ill befell King Louis and his family. The National Assembly demanded that Prussia and Austria remove their troops from the border, which they had stationed there. Tensions then escalated, and in April 1792, the National Assembly preemptively declared war on Prussia and Austria.
Sounds like they earned it.
Well, the French army at this point was poorly organized and racked by desertion, so the Prussian and Austrian armies won a string of decisive victories. King Louis was partially to blame for the defeats and relations between him and the National Assembly, and the common people declined until the insurrection of the 10th of August, 1792, when a crowd stormed Tuileries Palace and seized the king and his family and took them before the National Assembly. The assembly temporarily relieved the king of his duties, and after being emboldened by a stunning French military victory over the Prussians at Valmy, which was really more like a stalemate, but still bolstered French confidence after so many military defeats, the National Assembly voted to abolish the monarchy on the 22nd of September. The king was put on trial, found guilty of quote-unquote conspiracy against public liberty and general safety, and by a margin of 361 to 228, was sentenced to death, which was carried out via guillotine on January 21st, 1793.
He was guilty of being a king, basically.
Yep. And they didn't like it. He didn't support the Republican Revolution. One aspect of the revolution that I didn't mention, but want to include here, is the slow radicalization of the National Assembly. In the beginning, they just wanted to reform, but not have a revolution. But kind of at every step along the way and at every decision point and inflection point, the more radical side won out. A great king, or maybe even a good king, might have shepherded France through the needed reforms and transition. But King Louis XVI, while he was often enthusiastic and well-meaning, was ultimately just a mediocre king. If times had been good, he probably would have kept the ship of state afloat and been remembered as an unremarkable monarch. But times were not good, and King Louis XVI ultimately lost his head for it. The trend of radicalization will continue after the execution, and the original radicals that set the whole thing in motion won't be radical enough for those that currently are in power. You might have heard the phrase, the revolution eating its children. Well, that's where this comes from.
Okay.
The execution of King Louis XVI horrified the conservative monarchies of Europe. Spain and Portugal joined It's a mystery. Spain and Portugal joined the anti-French Austria-Prussia coalition, and in anticipation of their reactions, France declared war on Britain and the Dutch Republic in February.
Yeah, so where are we in all this?
When we were on death's door, when we were needy, we made a promise, we signed a treaty. We needed money and guns and half a chance. Who provided those funds?
France.
In return, they didn't ask for land. Only a promise that we'd lend a hand and stand with them if they fought against oppressors. And revolution is messy, but now is the time to stand. Stand with our brothers as they fight against tyranny.
You must be out of your goddamn mind if you think the president is gonna bring the nation to the brink of meddling in the middle of a military mess. A game of chess where France is queen and kingless. We've signed a treaty with a king whose head is now in a basket. Would you like to take it out and ask it? Or should we honor our treaty King Louis' head? Do whatever you want. I'm super dead. Enough.
We're hanging out on the side. The Americans at first wanted to support the French Revolution, and they just kept getting more and more radical. Killed the king. And like Hamilton says, we made a pact with the king of France and his head's in a basket. Do you want to pull it out and ask it if we should support the French? In order to have the manpower then to fight this multi-front war, France instituted a national draft. The first round was passed in February and aimed to enlist 300,000 men, although it likely only actually enlisted 100 to 150,000. This draft was the final straw that caused the politically and religiously conservative Vendée region to erupt in insurrection in March, which would remain under arms until 1796.
Dang.
A few months later, while the war in the Vendée still raged on, other political disputes between the increasingly radicalized National Assembly and more conservative regions outside Paris caused a number of cities across France to rise up in the Federalist revolts. And then these had three really important consequences, especially to this story. First, in response to the external wars they were losing in these new internal revolts, the National Assembly created the Committee of Public Safety, which was given broad powers over the armed forces, judiciary, and legislature, and even the executive bodies and ministries of the convention. Over time, the Committee of Public Safety supplanted the National Assembly to become the de facto wartime government of France. If you've been wondering where the beheading that's associated with the French Revolution starts outside of that of King Louis, this is the time period where the committee begins the reign of terror in response to anti-revolutionary uprisings, rising anti-clerical sentiment, and urging of the poor lower classes of Paris. The National Assembly and the Committee of Public Safety were based in Paris, so were often more responsive to Parisian mobs than citizens outside of Paris. Between June 1793 and July 1794, at least 300,000 people were arrested and 16,594 were officially executed, generally by beheading via guillotine. Another 10,000 died in jail without trial.
Dang.
So this is where that part of the French Revolution comes. The National Assembly and then the Committee on Public Safety were basically taken over by the most radical of the most radical, saw everybody as an enemy of the revolution, which they had co-opted, and then started killing everybody to keep them in line.
And we live with these problems to today, right? Like, this is why nobody wants revolutions anywhere ever.
Because they just radicalized themselves. The second important event is that Napoleon distinguished himself. Napoleon, remember him? During the siege of Toulon, which was one of the cities that rose up during the Federalist revolts, by finding more than 100 cannons out in the countryside, training and organizing officers and soldiers to man them, and planning the artillery assault, which ultimately led to the capture of the rebel city and destruction of the French royalist fleet anchored there. Napoleon's success during the siege of Toulon caught the attention of the Committee of Public Safety, who promoted him to artillery general of the French Army of Italy. So it's this victory during these Federalist revolts that really catapulted Napoleon onto the national stage and set up his later successes.
Okay, I have a question.
Yes.
And you can tell me if you're about to get to it or something, but like, what does he think? What are Napoleon's core beliefs at this point in time? Like, is Napoleon a monarchist? Does Napoleon say, I'm just a soldier, like whoever gives me my orders is who's in charge? Like, what's his deal?
Napoleon, if he is to be believed, is a staunch Republican.
Okay.
He is all in supporting the revolution, supporting Republican values. Ultimately, I think he turns out to be more self-serving and interested in his own self than the Republic. But he is an outspoken Republican at this point.
Okay. So he's not upset that the King of France was allergic to guillotines and that one of them got him.
Nope.
Okay. So he's kind of, he's on board for most of this, but not.
You know, and some of it, I wonder, is like he can wash his hands of it. It's not him doing the killings.
Right.
He's not doing the Reign of Terror. He's doing his duty, bringing these rebels into line.
He would do well in the Star Wars universe, is what you're saying.
Yes. Finally, the wars on all fronts led the National Assembly to institute the Levée en masse. The first article of the Levée reads, quote, "Henceforth, until the enemies have been driven from the territory of the Republic, the French people are in permanent requisition for army service. The young men shall go into battle. The married men shall forge arms and transport provision. The women shall make tents and clothes and shall serve in the hospitals. The children shall turn old linen into lint, and the old men shall repair to the public places to stimulate the courage of the warriors and to preach the unity of the Republic and hatred of kings."
What do you think about that, Jody?
What does it mean to turn linen into lint?
That's what sticks out to you, not the fact that an entire nation was just conscripted into the war machine?
And we get to turn linen into lint?
No, kids do. You work in the hospital, I think.
Yeah, and make tents and clothes.
No.
Just a slow shake of the head, huh?
So the Levée en masse is important historically because it's really the first time that such a national levy had been implemented successfully and really set the tone for succeeding wars up to and including World War I and World War II. Wars weren't fought just by mercenaries or a handful of paid specialists as they had been during the medieval and Renaissance periods. They were fought by the common man, a nation under arms in defense of a country. Beyond this historical importance, the ability of France to raise 800,000 fighting men, 10 times more than the Austrian-Prussian army, allowed them to stymie efforts of European monarchies to crush the revolution and gave Napoleon a gigantic force to utilize when he rose to power. By the end of... What?
And that never went wrong ever. That's the greatest thing. Yep. This is like the Zap Brannigan principle. Waves and waves of my own men against my enemies.
Except at first it's like that, but then they turn into an actually competent fighting force.
Sure. Sure. Go on.
Okay. By the end of 1793, the Federalist revolts had been put down, and during 1794, the French military won a string of decisive victories in what is now Belgium and the Rhineland of modern Germany, and made successful incursions into Spain and Catalonia and Navarre. These combined internal and external military successes undermined the authority and need for the Committee of Public Safety. The committee was put up because the French were losing. Everybody was in revolt, but now things had changed. In response to this and the Reign of Terror more generally, members of the National Assembly coordinated the Termidorian Reaction, which saw the arrest and execution of the leaders of the Committee of Public Safety and devolution of the powers of the committee back to the Assembly.
It's like an Ouroboros. It's just like all eating its own tail.
Yep. 1795 brought further military victories to France as they occupied the Netherlands and set up the Batavian Republic as a puppet state or sister republic. Prussia, Spain, and Tuscany were forced to sign peace treaties with France, which weakened the coalition against the Republic. Napoleon was transferred to the Army of the West, which was engaged in the still raging war in the Vendée. Remember the Vendée, that one? All of the other Federalist revolts had been put down, but the Vendée was still under arms.
Still blazing.
Yep. As an infantry commander, which he saw as a demotion because he was an artillery general. Napoleon protested this transfer based on poor health and was instead posted to Paris. In a fortunate turn of events for him, the Royalists, who still wanted to bring the king back, at least one of the king's relatives, led an insurrection in Paris, the Battle of 13 Vendemiaire, in response to a new constitution the National Assembly had approved. Paul Barras, the leader of the Thermidorian reaction, heard an insurrection was brewing and gave Napoleon command of improvised forces charged with defending the National Assembly based on his conduct during the Siege of Toulon. Napoleon gave an order to acquire 40 cannons around 1 a.m. and had them in place with commanding fields of fire when the first probing attacks from the royalists came at 5 a.m. The major royalist assault came a few hours later, and even though they were outnumbered 6-1, the Republicans managed to beat back the attack through effective cannon fire. So again, here's Napoleon being the preeminent artillerist of his day, using cannons to kind of make his mark. Thomas Carlyle, a Scottish historian who wrote one of the major histories of the French Revolution, marks this as the end of the revolution and said that Napoleon did it, quote, with a whiff of grape shot. Grape shot being grape-sized metal balls that are packed into canisters that are packed into cannons. So it's like a giant shotgun when you fire it into a crowd. Unlike the typical, you know, round, solid shot that are used in cannons and other places. Although not everybody agrees that this is when the revolution ended. The new constitution established a bicameral legislature with a unique 5-man executive branch, the Directory, which promoted Napoleon to general and within 5 months gave him command over the Army of Italy and recognition of his service during the Battle of 13 Vendemiaire. So you can see like these string of successes that Napoleon's having, especially close to the assembly, is like kind of propelling him in this meteoric rise through the ranks.
Which definitely is not going to go to his head.
Nope. When Napoleon arrived to take command of the Army of Italy, the war along the Italian border had ground on without much movement either way for 3 years. The Army of Italy was in the worst shape of any of the French armies, with low supplies and morale. And to a lesser general, the situation might have seemed like a punishment or way to get him out of the spotlight, which the Directory probably thought it was. However, Napoleon seized the moment and immediately took his army on an offensive against the allied forces of the Kingdom of Piedmont Sardinia in Austria, which in what is now northwestern Italy. He was outstandingly successful and knocked Piedmont Sardinia out of the war in 2 weeks. Napoleon then won a series of victories across northern Italy, pushed into the Austrian heartland to within 100 miles of Vienna, and forced the Holy Roman Emperor Francis II to sue for peace in April 1797. Within the peace treaty was a secret clause that promised the Republic of Venice to Austria in exchange for Lombardy. So Napoleon then marched on Venice and conquered the Republic, ending 1,100 years of independence. Venice, who wasn't even involved, gets their lands taken away because Napoleon promised it. During the Italian campaign, Napoleon became more influential within French politics by founding two newspapers. His army also seized the equivalent of $45 million in funds and $12 million in precious metals, which helped bolster the French economy in his own image. They go out, seize all this stuff, bring it back to France, which the economy is still in shambles, and that really helps. Royalist sentiment was on the rise in France during this time as the Thermidorian reaction drug on and the Directory implemented unpopular laws and heavy-handed justice. Royalists had won 87 of the 161 seats in the legislative body and 2 of the 5 seats in the Directory during the elections of 1795, and the Republicans who controlled the government feared the Royalists would be swept into power in the next election. To forestall this, Paul Barras and his co-conspirators engineered the coup of 18 Fructidor. Napoleon sent troops to support the coup, which was successful in driving the Royalists from government by nullifying election results and arresting Royalist representatives, but also left the Directory dependent upon him for security, which seems like a poor decision. Leaning on his popularity due to his success in Italy and subsequent influence with the Directory, Napoleon pitched the idea of invading Egypt to the Directory, which might seem like an odd choice. but it made sense to them at the time. And I think that's where we'll leave it. Napoleon on the edge of invading Egypt for what modern listeners might think is no good reason.
So just to be clear, like, he's not in charge.
Nope. He is a general and has come to the forefront because he helped a coup and said, hey guys, let's march on Egypt. And they said, go for it.
Wow. It just seems like, to me, looking back, like, as somebody who probably doesn't really understand this fully, like, the way that he manipulates all this is completely bonkers. Like, a parallel to me would be Eisenhower showed back up after the war and was like, you know what we should do? We should take over Brazil. And Harry Truman was like, I don't know why, man, but I'm really vibing with that idea.
So we'll get into next episode why Napoleon pitched Egypt. If you look at it, if you look at the reasons at the time, there are reasons it makes kind of sort of sense.
It's not even necessarily for me about the fact that he picked Egypt. It's about the fact that he could come back and be like, hey, what's up, bosses? We should invade this other place. And that they were like, okay, yeah, not a bad idea.
You know, though, it's the late 1700s, early 1800s. This is like the peak of colonial expansion.
Sure.
You've got, you know, the race for Africa coming up. Britain had been planting colonies like America all over the place. So like invading somewhere that is seen as lesser than is not necessarily like looked down upon. If you're a big European nation state and you've got the manpower to go subjugate some other lesser, quote unquote, lesser country, like at this point, like just go do it.
I could see why they would want. Yeah. Like I don't doubt their motivations necessarily. I doubt their motivations for listening to Napoleon about anything. Like, how is it? It amazes me when you look at people throughout history like this guy who, like, what? It's the only thing that really could make you say, like, oh, maybe the great man of history, quote unquote, stuff. Like, how did they do it? How did they convince these people in charge of them? Like, how can they not see their signing? I know hindsight is 2020, but they are setting themselves up to deal with this dude.
Yep. Well, from their perspective, you know, let's send him off to Egypt. He either goes off and dies, which is fine. We get him out of the public spotlight because Egypt is so far away, which is great. If he somehow wins, like, that does help France. It will have to deal with him at that point, but France will be better.
Yeah.
Like they recognize, like, it's the whole reason they gave him the army command of the Army of the Alps or Army of Italy. They recognize that he is a threat to them.
Okay. Like they are acutely aware of the fact that Napoleon is a dude on the, like, he is a wolf in wolf's clothing.
Yes. Or at least he is someone that could challenge them because he's popular.
Okay.
And has an army.
So they're not as dumb as I was making them out to be moments ago.
No, I think they look at sending, like, Napoleon pitches Egypt and they're like, yeah, that is a great idea. Get out.
We will see you when we see you, my dude.
Yep. Yeah. So that is a quick and dirty summary of the French Revolution. Like I said, there's so much I left out in so many important names. And important people that we just glossed over.
You boiled, like, what? You said 10 years of history down into a 60-minute podcast, sort of?
Yep.
What'd you think, Jody? Ready to join up with Napoleon?
That's a lot. Now I know why I couldn't learn all that. So what, like, can we do any, like, if we could read or do one thing to look up about Egypt? Like, what one thing would you want us to look up for the next?
Oh, for next?
Yeah.
There's a couple things. Look up the Mamluks, who were the ruling kind of party in Egypt. The fascinating thing about them is that they're not Egyptian. So Egypt at this time, and one of the reasons Napoleon thinks he is going to be welcomed by the Egyptians, is that Egypt is not ruled by Egyptians. Hmm. It's ruled by the Mamluks, who are ostensibly owe their allegiance to the Ottoman Empire, but de facto are independent. Look up that and look up Orientalism, which, you know, I say that you might think of China or Japan or maybe even India. But at this point in time, Orientalism really meant, from a European perspective, anything that was East, which included the Ottoman Empire and Egypt, because they were east of Europe and they were kind of the closest thing, the closest political body to Europe. Like, the British were trading with India at this point by going around Africa, but Orientalism, and it really encompassed anything east of Europe. And those are going to be, so those two things are going to be important for the motivations of Napoleon invading Egypt. I guess I'll drop it here too. The thing that kills his troops off is plague. They march into Egypt and then into Syria, and it goes well for a little bit, and then they all get plague and die. So if you want to bone up on how plague works, that would probably be good too.
All right, so close us out here, Arthropod Napoleon.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode of Arthropod. I hope that the Napoleon podcast has become was interesting. Next time, we're going to dive into Napoleon's invasion of Egypt in the Middle East and how his troops got absolutely wrecked there by plague. And so we'll talk about the campaign and plague itself, where it came from, what it does. And I hope this has been interesting. I'm really fascinated by all of this, and I hope that comes across, and I hope that you all found it as exciting as I do. You can find us on the web at http://www.arthro-pod.blogspot.com. You can find me on Twitter at mscavarla36.
I am at Bugman John.
I am at Jody Bugs Me UNL.
Thank you for listening.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod Gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
Sacre bleu.